Thank you. Such a beautiful song. Hey, everybody. Yeah, this feels like a joint effort between, well, maybe all of us, but between me and David Dean. Sort of we, meaning he, sort of cooked up this as a question. What is home? Just before I left for Colorado, and I thought, yeah, that seems like a great question. What is home, and why do we long for it? And is it both the place we long for and the place we long to be free from? These are good questions. And I agree, home is complicated. I was thinking about that even like listening to the accordion, because I love the accordion, and my dad, I never really thought of as much of a musician, really. He couldn't sing, like, which is, when I mean he couldn't sing, I mean it sounded terrible. And then one day, I mean, I was, you know, probably in my 20s or something, he's like, I can play the accordion. I was like, cannot. And he picked one up, and I was like, what the heck? Like, where has that been? I had no idea. Something about something he had to learn in Belfast, where he grew up, which is another odd, you know, question. Like, when you are born somewhere and live most of your life somewhere else, where is home, you know? Even this morning, I was making my coffee, and there was something about the smell of it, and it reminded me, you would think I would be thinking about this, but I wasn't thinking. The smell reminded me of being on the northern coast of Ireland. I have no idea why, but that's what popped into my head. I was like, oh. I was thinking about the landscape and the wildness that still is much of Northern Ireland, and yet I was born in Virginia, you know, to the son of immigrants, and I'll probably never live in Virginia again. But when I die, I could easily conjure up a certain image that I have right now in my mind of the way the hills are, the Appalachians against the sky. It's like, man, what is that? Why is that, like, create a certain kind of longing or grief or even love? Like, where does that come from? Where does that reside? And and what about the question of belonging and the question of being known? And so these are like just things that are just arising, listening to the meditation and the songs this morning. And here's the reading. This is from Rebecca Solnit. The stars we are given, she says, the stars we are given, the constellations we make. And I was just in Colorado at 9,000 feet for 10 days. So a place where you can still see constellations and the Milky Way and the Black Bear, and which walked through my camp and gave me a little look. And amazing. The stars we are given, the constellations we make. That is to say, stars exist in the cosmos, but the constellations are the imaginary lines we draw between them. And actually, I want to ask her, are they imaginary? Is that the thing that's at work? Maybe. First time I saw a scorpion, for some reason. Never really noticed it before, but just, you know, 5 days ago. I was like, oh, there it is. The readings we give the sky, the stories we tell. So she's sort of dancing between the givenness of the stars and our imaginative, storytelling, innate, intuitive disposition toward story making and meaning making. And so we create stories out of the night sky. And then she says this, the desire to go home, that is the desire to be whole. That seems right to me. The desire to go home, that is the desire to be whole, to know where you are, to be the point of intersection of all the lines drawn through the stars, to be the constellation maker and the center of the world, so to speak, the center called love, to awaken from sleep, to rest from awakening, to tame the animal, to let the soul go wild, to shelter in darkness and blaze with light, to cease to speak and be perfectly understood. This is quite a poetic musing. You could read this a half a dozen times over the next couple days, and there'd probably be a lot of richness in here. There's something about this final line, to cease to speak and be perfectly understood. You know, that's that like the place where you're known, you know? And isn't that what home is? It's like the place where you're known and also the place that you're not known. Maybe you didn't have this feeling. I had a feeling as a kid that these weren't my real parents. I don't know. It was just like, and I would wonder, I'd be like, is it possible? Because it doesn't seem like they are. Like, was there like some sort of swap at birth, you know? I also felt like very strongly that I was living in the wrong era. Like I was like 100 years minimum, like too late. I should have been born at least a minimum of 100 years ago. This is like from when I was a little kid. I don't know why. So it's a place, home is, I suppose, a place where you're known and also a place where you experience not being known, something like that. Okay, so today I want to, let me see how many points I have. I have 6 points. I'm going to try to get to them all. And don't worry, as always, all your questions will be answered. There'll be no more ambiguity. You'll be filled with certainty, and you'll go off into the world and conquer. Okay, so here's point number one. We are nomadic people, like as a species. We are nomadic. How do we know that? Because you're here in this part of the world. That's how we know that. And I want to dispel something that I think we're learning from evolutionary biology anyway. And here's what I want to dispel, that we have greatly evolved from our ancestors. Our consciousness is so much more enlightened and rich and nuanced, unlike our unsophisticated human ancestors. I don't think that that's the case. In fact, just if you do the math alone, you realize how little time on the grand scheme of things, how much time has passed between us and our, quote, nomadic ancestors. And you have that in you. It's alive. I know that because some of you in the winter are not here. Okay? We move around. And that's both been a blessing and a curse for life and for the planet. And the other animals move around too. And I mean, maybe you've seen those, like, this is like junior high, sort of middle school evolution teaching. But, you know, you take the length of the time of just the earth itself, and it's something like a football field. And where are we on the football field? Well, somewhere around the 1 yard line is just what we think of as the planet as it exists now. And somewhere close to the inch of that 1 yard line is what we think of as human evolution. And 200,000 years ago, when our ancestors were hunters and gatherers, that's you. Like, I know our consciousness has evolved a little bit, and our technology has evolved, and technology just does shift our awareness of the world. That's why they name them things like the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. These are all things, you know, I'm supposed to be an expert in from graduate school. But my point is, very little time has passed. You are a hunter-gatherer. You're a nomad. That's what I'm saying. You're a nomad. And so the question of home has been something that we have carried. And it's both a psycho-spiritual question and a question of physical geography, of land, of river and stream and ocean and soil and relationship with plants and animals, and also the what we would now call the psychological or the spiritual conversation that takes place there. It's not just practical. There's something about the dynamic between the feeling sense of home and relatedness and the practicality of home and relatedness. Like, can we live here? Is it safe? Is it good enough? That kind of thing. That's my first point. And so what would we expect to find if we're nomadic? We would expect to find stories that would involve the following themes: exile, wandering, return, longing, home, repeat. That is every myth you've ever read. That is the Bible that is for sale in the lobby. I'm sorry, I was trying not to work that in, but I worked it in. I have a study Bible too, you know, it's... I'm sorry. If you're watching online, that makes no sense at all, so, and I'm not going to explain it. All right, it's every story we've ever heard. It's the story of the butterfly here in the song, too. It's like exile, wandering, return, longing, home, and then some kind of repeat. Okay, that's point number one. Point number two, I wanted to spell another, I don't like to call them myths because I'm a fan of myth, another caricature. And that is that the sacrificial systems that we find in every single ancient culture that we know of come from primitive and dumb ideas about the way the world works. All right? Most people think, oh, our ancestors were really afraid of the gods. And if they didn't cut up animals and feed the gods, then they were going to be burned. You know, this kind of thing. That's a cliche. It's pretty deep in especially Western Christian consciousness, mainly. But that is, now, whether or not they were afraid of the gods or not is neither here nor there. Some gods are quite terrifying, and other gods, you know, maybe not so much. But that's neither here nor there. The sacrificial systems that our ancient ancestors came up with was really about relationship with the land. Like plants, animals, water sources, and weather. To be out of relationship with the land was a serious problem. And even if you take the biblical feasts, there are something like 7 or 8 feasts. All of them weren't invented by the Hebrew people, but were sort of shared among their neighbors. They're just it's the agrarian cycle. That's all it is. It's agriculture. Now you could ask what were nomadic people doing, but I don't want to do a whole thing on that, but let's just stick with agriculture for the time being. So every single time of year, something important happened agriculturally, like rains or harvest or planting. And in order to make that sacred, they came up with these systems that what we're given from the earth, we give a portion of it back. And there wasn't a division between God and the earth or the gods and the earth. That you were in the land of such and such a god, and they meant that quite physically. It's a much more incarnated view as far as we can tell from the few sources that we have on this kind of stuff. In other words, they didn't have like the watchmaker view of God. Like, I don't know if you ever heard that argument. It's like, if you found a watch on the beach, you would think there was a watchmaker. Well, what's revealing about that is a much more cold and distant god. That's a much more modern mechanistic notion of God than our ancestors had. The gods were infused in the land. So where am I going with this? The sacrificial systems of the world invited ordinary people into, a word I've used before here, sacred reciprocity with the places that they lived. All right? They're in a sacred, reciprocal relationship with the land. Now, you think, well, we don't really have that anymore. I guarantee you, if our water system was poisoned, like it was in Rockford, where I grew up, you would change your mind about that. And you would realize that, oh, I am in a reciprocal relationship with the aquifers of the earth. And if we don't orient ourselves in just the right kind of way, we're going to poison ourselves and everyone else. Have I made sense? All I'm saying is the sacrifices were an example of that. I'll give a portion here. I'll make certain prayers. I'll recognize that next year this may not come. I need to behave in a certain way in order for there to be, you know, productive crops, so forth and so on. Now, what does that have to do with home? That's what one definition of home, the kind of place in which you are in a kind of sacred reciprocal relationship. When you're not in that kind of relationship, things go haywire. Then what kind of relationship is? It's just a relationship of resources, mine for the taking. I'm going to get all I can while I can. That's not a very sacred reciprocal relationship. So it poses a problem when it comes to home. All right, point number three. And this is great. Thanks. So thanks, David, for starting us off, because I want to talk about Eden too. So one of the interesting things about the Genesis story is that the point of the story is that they got kicked out of Eden. Like, that's the point. And it's an important point to make. It's sort of saying consciousness looks like living east of Eden. All right, that's what consciousness looks like. And that's what human consciousness looks like. It's a kind of gift. It's a kind of terrible gift, the book of Genesis. Like, here you go. This is what it means to be human. Oh, out of the womb, out of Eden, you get kicked. And you can't go back. And in the Genesis story, there's an angel with a flaming sword that prevents Adam and Eve from going back to Eden. Which I'm telling you, you read this story, and it's kind of terrible. I used to teach high school religion and Bible, and my students would, you know, they'd be talking about this, and I remember one student saying something like, "I'm just so sad that Adam and Eve ate the," well, it doesn't say apple, but that's what they said. They ate the apple, and it could have been, we could have just, like, you know, been in paradise forever. And I felt something like, that's the wrong reading of the story. It's like every time you hear a story and it begins with, all right, you could have, this is great, everything is perfect, you can have every, all your needs are met, except you can't do this one thing, which is eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know what's going to happen in the story, correct? That's what's going to happen. It's like, that's in every single myth that we know of. Whatever is forbidden, you're going to go toward it. And that's part of the human condition. And so what the story is saying is, once they dine from consciousness, and they're aware of death and mortality and morality and ethics, you cannot go back. You're kicked out forever, but now you're fully human. What were you before? Well, you're in the womb, so to speak. So the Garden of Eden is playing with the womb imagery. The womb is great. You're all comfortable, you're warm, you got your little umbilical cord, you know. It's, everything is just pumped into you. It's like, what's that movie? WALL-E, is that it? Is that little, someone help me out. Okay, WALL-E, they're hooked up to this machine. Yeah, on the other planet, and they're like all in these lazy boys, and that's the womb, okay? And from a psychological point of view, that is that pull that will never go away. I wish I could go back to the womb, okay? Some people call that marriage, you know? Take care of all my needs. Pump me full of, whatever, so forth and so on. So it's like, yeah, there it is. But the Garden of Eden story is saying you're kicked out of that forever, and it's going to suck. And that's not a direct quote, but it says that there will be pain in childbirth. It's going to hurt, all right? And you're going to have to work, you have to toil. It's not just going to fall from trees and be a paradise. And it's not the umbilical cord anymore. You have to cut that. That's why cutting the umbilical cord was always a sacred rite of passage. You can't go back to the womb, it's saying. Although, here's the little caveat, we still feel the pull. So if you're asking the question of what is home and why do we long for it, well, partly we long for what we cannot have. We long for that kind of blessed oceanic union that we can't quite ever get back to. That's part of the human condition. And so we're kicked out east of Eden. And now we have to figure out what it means to be conscious. And that's why we're wanderers. That's why we're in exile. And we go from place to place, practically, but also spiritually, psychologically. We're that longing is wakes up, and we meet someone and we think, maybe this is my Eden, you know? Like, you've heard two lovers, like, it feels like, you know, I've always known you, even though we've been talking for 5 minutes and we've had five drinks, you know, this kind of thing. I feel like I've always known you, and you know, what's being activated there? Well, partly that completion that we feel, you know, incomplete in some way. It's like what she says here. The desire to call home is the desire to be whole. Okay. Okay, let me just add a little PS to that. So, if that's the case, there's this womb-like longing, an Eden-like longing. You can fill in the blank with other kinds of metaphors and images. One of the things that I think manifests itself as sort of important archetypally is the family hearth, the family fire. It becomes the sort of place that is a physical and also spiritual center point of longing, and it's mobile for nomadic people. Like, what do I mean? You pick it up and take it with you. That's what I mean. Like, in the Bible, there's this very strange passage. Now I'm all into the Bible all of a sudden. Abraham has, like, this vision sort of thing, and in the vision it says there's a clay smoking pot in the middle of his vision, and, you know, when I was a teenager, I thought, see, they smoke weed back then. There it is, pretty simple. But anyway, that the clay pot was the place where you put the ashes, so that if you're a nomadic person, the coals, I mean, not the ashes. So as a nomadic person, you don't always have to start a fire. You can take it with you. Okay, that's the beginning of the hearth. So it's like you've got this nomadic thing, and you have this sort of centerpiece of the home, and that is very, very deep. How many of you, if you move into a new apartment, a new house, have to spend a lot of time rearranging things? Anyone? That's that same impulse. That's carrying the coals from home, hearth, belonging, center, some kind of centering presence, and you have to rearrange things. It doesn't quite feel right. When my wife and I moved from Israel back to the States, after graduate school, we had never owned a home before, and we had always rented, and my parents said that we'd like to help you get a home. I was like, no problem. We'll help you out a little bit with the down payment, and we've got a realtor. Don't worry about it. So this is a huge gift to me and my wife, and so here we are in our little apartment in Abu Tor, and get an email from the realtor. Here, found the house, looking at images of the house, looks great. Meanwhile, I just want to give a little context, the war with Lebanon is going on, so Hezbollah's firing rockets, and it's a very tense time to be living in Israel. And so the house that I'm looking at online is looking really good in light of the, you know, Hezbollah. So anyway, we say, yes, sign us up. We'll do it. It's in Heritage Hill in Grand Rapids. That's where my parents lived. And it's right on the edge of Heritage Hill, furthest south you can get. It needs a little work, but it's move-in ready. That was the phrase. I was like, move-in ready? Sign me up. So we get off the plane, and like the next day we have to sign the papers and see the house all in one shot. And I walk in, and it's not my definition of move-in ready. I mean, I'll just be honest. The brick kitchen that I thought was brick online was faux brick and was covering up moldy plaster and something like 10,000 cockroaches. You know, the ceiling looked a little lumpy, and I realized there are about 7 layers of plaster covering up a leak that somebody had been trying to cover up for, I don't know, 50 years. So what happened to us? Well, besides freaking out and blaming and finger pointing and hating the realtor and all this kind of stuff, we signed the papers and moved in, and it didn't feel like a home. Like, it felt off, and some kind of compass went off, which was, if we don't make changes here, this is not gonna work. And we spent about 8 years making those changes. And it really wasn't until I looked behind every single wall in that house and tore everything out that I felt like it was becoming home. You know, it was taking those coals and trying to situate them somewhere in the hearth. And I want to ask, where does that come from inside us? It is a kind of orienting feature. And when it's not there, it's, you know, something feels like it's missing. So home, my point here, is something we also co-create. It's something we experience sort of physically in an actual place in a land where we eat food and we, you know, there's a kind of economy at work, and it's also a smaller thing that we co-create, that it feels like there's a kind of artistry involved. Have you ever been invited to someone's house and you can tell they have really done a good job and it really feels like home, both to them, but you also feel, in a way, at home there? It's not just like a cookie cutter thing. They need to just go to, is Art Van still a place? I don't think it is. Like an Art Van living room, like I'll take that, and it just like gets transplanted. And no, there's like character to it. There's nuance and beauty, and these things matter. All right, point number four. I'm gonna run out of time here. That's all right. Okay, this comes from Bill Plotkin, one of my teachers. And so he calls, one of his definitions for the soul is what he calls an ecological niche, which I think is an interesting phrase, an ecological niche. And he partly says that because all things have souls in that sense. They inhabit a place. It's an ecological niche. The butterfly inhabits an ecological niche in the web of life. And that oak tree out there is itself, by itself, doing its own thing. It inhabits its own soul by inhabiting an ecological niche. And human beings are a little more complicated in how they inhabit an ecological niche. Like what's happening with the geese going north, south, is north home, is south home? And well, I don't know the answer to that question. It's a good one. If we step back, we can see, at the very least, they're inhabiting an ecological niche that is somewhat fixed in the world, unless there's some sort of natural disaster, their habitat changes, something like that. But with human beings, it's more complicated. What is your ecological niche? So that's one of those questions I'm not going to try to answer, but I'm weaving it into the question of home, because part of what's happening on the level of the soul is that we're longing for the place that we call our own. Here. Here is where I stand. Here is where I know myself and I'm known. A sense of belonging. And with human beings, a sense of cooperation. Conscious cooperation with the place that I'm inhabiting. That's an ecological niche. Or at least partly to define such a phrase. And part of that ecological niche, we could also call discovering more of our wholeness. I'm getting that from Rebecca Solnit's quote here, to desire to go home is the desire to be whole. It's like a rounding out, a filling out. I feel more myself here, standing in this place, being in this place. And maybe it's not so fixed, because what was my first point? We're nomadic people. So it might change, or there might be it can evolve in some way. Okay, point number five. I am going to finish all my points. Point number five. I want to read to you some David White lines here. Recently, I was in L.A., and I hate L.A., and I also really like L.A. It's like awesome and terrible at the same time. I went to the farmer's market in L.A., I think I told you this, and eggs were $14 a dozen. I could literally FedEx my friends eggs for cheaper than what it costs to just buy them at the farmer's market. So, and two steps down from the farmer's market where I was CVS, where there's a homeless encampment on the sidewalk. I don't know if you've been to LA recently, but homelessness is wild right now. Whole encampments popping up overnight. And so we're talking about some of the most high-end real estate and fancy shops. I can't even think of like fancy brands. Gucci. All right, there's the Gucci shop, and next to it is just a guy sleeping. I mean, it is wild right now. And there's something about homelessness that I don't want to minimize it by doing this, so hear me say that. That is, from a symbolic point of view, it's mirroring something back to us as a culture about our own homelessness, about our own lostness, I might say. a culture that is that lost. In the place in America, at Los Angeles, where the most creativity and the most cultural influences bubble up, you have this massive problem of lostness and homelessness just staring us in the face. So there's the feeling and the experience of being exiled is the word I'm working toward here. Exiled, like we're in exile, we're east of Eden. There's something about our culture that's exiling. We feel exiled from our sometimes our family of origin. So exile is kind of hovering in the background here. Let me read to you some David White here. So he says that we carry a kind of longing for belonging. And this longing is a certain kind of woundedness. The woundedness around not belonging, we could say. And one part of us knows what it's like to live in exile, he says. I'm sort of paraphrasing things here. And so he says, and here's what's interesting. When we feel the experience of exile, being exiled from ourselves, a feeling of our culture being exiled from something, he says the most important thing is to turn our face toward home. So here we get a kind of paradox. We feel like we don't belong, and we turn our face toward home. Now, the question is, what is home? But it's that orienting compass that he says is the most important turn. So it's like when you're standing there and you see that Gucci and Adidas have come up, have combined for this like awesome new brand. There it is, like, just gotta have the Gucci Adidas shoes, which would be kind of cool now that I think of it. And this is a real thing, by the way. I'm not just making that up. There really was a partnership between Gucci and Adidas. And there it is, and I turn and I see homelessness. It's like, we feel like, what's going on? The exile is present, is what I'm saying. And David White says, so time to turn towards home, which is like, okay, what's going on here? What really matters? What's at stake here? What's happening in our world? And you turn your face toward home, he says. Okay, I'm going to pause there because I want to get to my last point here. I'm going to read you a poem to conclude things here. And my point this morning has been just to stir the cauldron here in the family hearth and to awaken our own longing, our own sense of exile, our own sense of home, our own wonderings about what is my place in the world and my own geographical niche, my own ecological niche. And to maybe spin that out a little bit and wonder something like, if we don't come back into a more right relationship with home, with the earth as our home, things are going to get a lot worse. And we're feeling that, and we're now reaching something like 8 billion people on the planet. And I don't want to now turn into a doomsday list of possibilities, but moving from place to place and people being uprooted from places because of various catastrophes of one way or another, it's not like it's coming, it's already here. And it awakens all these wonderings that I'm spinning around here, like what is home and is it possible to return to a kind of sacred reciprocity with the world and with our relations, both human and more than human, and what about displacement, and what about exile, and what kind of compass is going to point us in the right sort of direction? These are things that I want to just stir around in this morning. So here's one of my favorite poems. Speaking of home, it's called Lost. All right, it's a David Wagner poem, Lost. And I want you to hear how he's subtly playing with the theme here, lost. First of all, here's the first line. Stand still. I'm going to do some interpreting here. Stand still, he says. Wait a minute. when you're lost,
speed up.
Like, look for where you are, except if you've, like, I'm a wilderness first responder. And when you're training people out in the wild, if they get lost, guess what the advice is? Don't move. Guess what you feel like doing? Running as fast as possible. Moving quickly. So he says, okay, when you're lost, stand still. So here you can start to feel the sort of the pulls that are in our psyches. Stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. They know their ecological niche, if you want to sound fancy. The trees ahead and the bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here. And you must treat it as a powerful stranger. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger. Already, in my view, there's a little hint of sacred reciprocity. The world, the aquifers, Lake Michigan, the oak tree, these little grasses on the roof, powerful strangers. How would you get to know a stranger? What would be required for you to get to know such strangers? Okay, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger, must ask permission to know it and to be known. Feel the themes of belonging here? To know a place, to know a particular patch of forest, to know a particular tree. How many of you, I would actually like a show of hands, can remember a particular tree from childhood? I'll see. What is that? Did you all get the memo? Like, once the umbilical cord was cut, you got a little memo that said, you're going to find a childhood tree, and you're going to, no. It's like, what is that? Okay? Well, it's to be known and to know. And, yeah, I remember climbing my favorite tree, a little maple tree, and it was the first time I ever saw a cicada shell. You ever seen those? It's cicadas in Virginia. Oh, my God. Talk about an alien that will freak the crap out of you. And you want to get close to it, and you don't. Maybe it's still alive, and it's sticky. It sticks to the bark. Oof. Amazing. A powerful stranger indeed. Okay, he goes on. The forest breathes. So listen. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. I have made this place around you. Talk about something we've forgotten as civilizations. We've carved out a place in the forest and forgot that the forest is the thing that made this place possible in the first place. And you and I, there on the very 1 inch of the 1 yard line. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, here. No two trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. You can feel the calculative modern mind saying, well, a tree is a tree. You know, it's a category. He says, to raven, no two trees are the same, and to the wren, no two branches are the same. And what if a tree or a bush? If what a tree or bush does, ecological niche, if what a tree or bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you, he says. So, in part, I want you to feel the unresolved tension here, that home, and I think a deeper sense of home, is a deep-seated longing that we carry. It's also, I think, part of the problem, the modern problem that we're facing right now, where there's a certain kind of homelessness and restlessness and lostness at work. And the search for it is important and good. And on the other side, You have a solution, a suggestion being something like, when you feel the lostness, stop, stand still, and be here, and let that shape you. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. So this tension between being found and looking, between the place we long for and the place we long to be free from, to quote David, this is the right kind of tension that creates the right kind of alchemical soup to stir in. So I'm feeling the energy of the kids running behind me right now. And a certain kind of like play that's required for the, I think, really deep and important question. I mean, if I just want to maximize it for my sort of final sentences, if we don't come into sacred, a more sacred reciprocal relationship with the planet that we share with other human beings and other plants and animals, we're in deep shit. And there's a certain kind of play and longing and posture that I think is required for that kind of dance to continue. So that's what I got for you today. Thank you.